The fall of Assad in Syria was huge, but we can't let it overshadow other pieces of important news out of the Middle East. And a new deal to form the world's largest trade bloc has been signed. It will affect your life dramatically, as Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Furey wrote in our Trumpet print magazine a few years ago. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Events in Syria are changing fast, with Bashar Assad kicked out last weekend. We did an update on Wednesday's show with the Trumpet Middle East correspondent Mihailo Zekic. I'd like to begin by talking to Mihailo today to get the latest update. And I think one of the big things that has come to the fore over the last few days has been Israel's involvement in Syria.
Yes. So rather than introducing it to you, I'll let Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu do it.
This is a historic day for the Middle East. The collapse of the Assad regime, the tyranny in Damascus, offers great opportunity, but also is fraught with significant dangers. This collapse is a direct result of our forceful action against Hezbollah and Iran, Assad's main supporters. It set off a chain reaction of all those who want to free themselves from this tyranny and its oppression. But it also means we have to take action against possible threats. One of them is the collapse of the Separation of Forces Agreement from 1974 between Israel and Syria. This agreement held for 50 years. Last night it collapsed. The Syrian army abandoned its positions. We gave the Israeli army the order to take over these positions to ensure that no hostile force embeds itself right next to the border of Israel. This is a temporary defensive position until a suitable arrangement is found. Equally, we send a hand of peace to all those beyond our border in Syria, to the Druze, to the Kurds, to the Christians, and to the Muslims who want to live in peace with Israel. We're going to follow events very carefully. If we can establish neighborly relations and a peaceful relations with the new forces emerging in Syria, that's our desire. But if we do not, we'll do whatever it takes to defend the state of Israel and the border of Israel.
That was a video he gave on an impromptu stop at the Golan Heights in northern Israel when news broke out that the Assad regime was finished. And bit of a beefy clip, he packed a lot in there, but it basically summed up everything that Israel has been doing for the past few days in dealing with what's going on in Syria. As Netanyahu mentioned, the Israeli Defense Forces moved in across the border into a part of the Golan Heights that is in Syria to take over positions that the Syrian army abandoned, again, to stop any random hostile force from taking it. Since then, they have made a few advances, and it is important to remember that the Golan Heights themselves are not that far away from Damascus. A lot of people were wondering, is Israel going to push all the way into Damascus? They've denied that. They said that they've gone as far as they're going to go as far as an actual troop movement is concerned. But that doesn't mean that they're not doing other maneuvers in the area to take care of their safety. Principally, sending airstrikes on hundreds of targets that were part of the official Syrian army's arsenal. And this includes sinking much of the already small Syrian navy, attacking sites related to chemical weapons developments, even entire squadrons of fighter planes. Israel doesn't want them getting control of that. But also, as you could tell from what Netanyahu was saying, and as we talked about last time, these new groups that are coming into power in Syria aren't exactly trustworthy. They're saying the right things in front of the TV cameras, but a jihadist is still a jihadist. It's maybe their first goal was to take over Syria. Maybe they didn't have the flood to Al-Aqsa in mind for most of this time. That doesn't mean that isn't their goal at some point. And we have seen clips from HDS's forces, for example, saying that Damascus is one, Jerusalem and Mecca are next. So Israel's response, while they are being very assertive, and obviously nobody is getting in the way of them at this point, they are holding their breath more or less to see what happens next.
And the United States has been involved as well. I guess is it the breakdown is Israel's been focusing more on Syrian military hardware, kind of left over from the Assad Syrian army, while the United States is focused on Islamic State targets.
Exactly, which is an interesting wrinkle when you consider the mass release of prisoners that HDS is doing. I mean, again, the TV cameras capture the innocent young girls like thrown in for saying the wrong things on social media, etc. But we are talking about thousands of people, and at least while the Assad regime was standing, there were roughly 10,000 prisoners from ISIS from previous phases of the war in those jails. So if HTS is going to be having a blanket release of the prisons, could we see a resurgence in the Islamic State? I don't know, but it's certainly the best chance they've had in a long time.
And I think it's also worth just taking a minute to reflect on the state of those prisons. I mean, we've seen a lot of pretty shocking footage over the last week of, you know, the torture facilities, basically, for Assad in Syria. And there's, you know, there's something there about the depths of man's depravity that, that will treat each other this way.
Syria is so isolated and doesn't necessarily pose a direct threat to a lot of Western countries like America. We don't necessarily hear how bad things are there, but one particular prison in Damascus, it's estimated 30,000 people got executed just from that one prison. You look at a lot of the international rankings, say on corruption, on media freedom, etc., and Syria, at least as of this year, most of those categories ranks even lower than North Korea in those perspectives. So we could talk about Assad as being maybe not a jihadist, maybe not a moderate, but that does not mean he's a good guy. He has a lot of blood of a lot of people on his hands.
Yeah, I mean, this is the real evil world that we live in, that Assad is gone. Yeah, a bad guy is out of office, but that also doesn't mean that everything is now going to be wonderful and United States and especially Israel are taking precautions to deal with that. And we've talked about on our Wednesday shows for the last couple of weeks about where this is heading, about, I think we've seen even just over the last few days more talk from Germany getting involved, the German defense minister going and visiting German troops in the region, in Jordan. Very interesting timing there, the German foreign minister kind of laying out her plans and ideas for Syria, people beginning talks about unlocking European funding. And we talked about on Wednesday show exactly where this is leading, and that watching for Germany to come in there and for Syria to move into the European camp, that is the key place to focus right now. Now, for the Middle East news, we have been rightly, I think, very focused on Syria for the last couple of weeks. There have been other important stories, though, that we need to get caught up on.
Yes, so on Friday, the news was sort of trickling out just as we were recording last week's program, but it is quite shocking news from the International Atomic Energy Agency, who sent an assessment of Iran's nuclear capabilities to its member states. And the main eye-opener from this report is that Iran has quadrupled, according to IAEA assessments, its stockpile of 60% enriched uranium. So we're talking about uranium that has been enriched, that has had work done with nuclear fission to produce it to an isotopic level that has no civilian application for it and is the hardest or at least biggest hurdle to reach when it comes to enrichment. The next level is 90% enrichment, which is not that much of a leap, and by that point it is weapons grade. This is not a coincidence that this has all been happening while everything we've been talking about with Syria and Lebanon before that has been happening. Iran has been investing a lot in Syria and Lebanon and Gaza to use almost as deterrence, like in case if the West decide to poke too hard, they could always say, well, we have these acolytes in all these neighboring countries that we're willing to trigger and cause chaos around the world if you step on us too hard, so you better play nicely. That insurance policy is gone. Iran denies it, as you'd expect them to, but there's no reason why they were doing anything near like this, except if they were planning on getting a bomb, and at this rate, while there's still a lot to do, say, in developing the payload system, etc., if they enrich the amounts of uranium they have right now, they'd have about enough for 4 nuclear weapons.
And they've been working on their space program. Even recently, we've had some more rocket launch, and I mean, fundamentally, a space rocket and an intercontinental ballistic missile aren't all that different. So in some ways, they are working on the payload system, or at least that part of it.
Well, they are, but you'll sometimes hear people talk about that Iran could have one, like, change all that material to weapons grade in one day. Like, it's obviously takes a lot more to put a nuclear weapon together.
Right, to miniaturize it,
yes,
to ruggedize
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. But with all that being said, one day is still one day.
Right, so this is an important reminder that as Iran is being defeated in Lebanon, as Iran is being defeated in Syria, they are not down and out, and they have other powerful ways of impacting the West.
Indeed.
And threatening, and certainly even hurting the West.
The reason we follow this is the term we obviously use, Bible prophecy, to analyze what's going on. Whenever I talk about Iran, our go-to prophecy is Daniel 11, verse 40, which talks about the King of the South, which our editor-in-chief has identified with Iran. But it's obviously important not just to look at that one little verse or the few little verses, but to keep going into the prophecy. It continues in Daniel 12, and verse 1 talks about everything that leads up to it, Iran, its push, its war with Europe, leading to a time of trouble such as there never was since there was a nation even to that time. And you could tie that in with related prophecies like Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22, which talks about a similar time where that would be unparalleled, except it adds the detail that if God didn't cut that short, there would not be a single person left alive on earth. This is talking about weapons of mass destruction. This is talking about nuclear weapons. And we don't necessarily expect Iran to be the one to bring the earth close to cosmocide, but certainly an unstable jihadist regime like this that's building nuclear weapons, that has shown intent on using them, it is certainly something a trend to watch as this prophecy goes forward. We have a trends article on our website called Why the Trumpet Watches Iran's Pursuit of Nuclear Weapons. I could go into a little bit more detail in that.
So Iran, we're not expecting them to be down and out. Now, we're watching for a clash between Europe and radical Islam. As part of that clash, we're watching for Europe to become much more of a Catholic power, much more of a Christian power, as it transforms into this new resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. And that's something we talk about in our book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. And as part of that, though, we are also watching for this Catholic European power to make common cause with some countries in the Middle East, like Syria, like Lebanon, like Turkey and Jordan and Saudi Arabia, to unite with them to ally against, to try and contain this rising Iranian power. And we did also see some pretty significant statements, symbolism, I should say, from Pope Francis this weekend that points to that alliance.
Very much, and more so, as we'll get into. On Saturday, the Pope formally inaugurated a nativity scene outside of Vatican City. The Vatican does this every year coming up to Christmas time, where they put up statues of, or rather idols of, what they consider Jesus, Mary, and Joseph against supposedly Christ's birth. And this particular year, quote-unquote baby Jesus is on a manger sitting on top of a keffiyeh, which, for our listeners that don't know, is the traditional Palestinian headdress Yasser Arafat is famous for wearing.
So Jesus isn't a Jewish baby, Jesus is a Palestinian baby.
Not only a Palestinian baby, but like
a terrorist baby.
Yes, exactly. And Francis for himself, the Palestinian Authority actually donated that statue, and Francis, of course, knew that, and he was present for its unveiling with members of the Palestinian Authority, including Ramzi Houri, who basically runs the PA's sovereign wealth fund, in presence watching it. And the Pope, for his part, made comments that the scene where this happened today, Bethlehem, is like full as where the tragedy of war is hitting right now. We need to stop the violence, stop the war. Bethlehem's not part of the war right now, unless, as Francis has made clear plenty of times before, you consider Israel having any presence in the area, legitimate security presence whatsoever, as being part of the war. You tie this in with what we talked about when it happened, the comments he made in his book about genocide. And tying that in, the Pope has really gotten a much more blatantly, openly anti-Israel in the symbolism that he displays, as you mentioned, in his public statements, in the reaction, and the Catholic Church's reaction under him to those public statements, even inviting Fatah officials, which, as we've discussed before, participated in the October 7 massacre, at least the party, to Vatican City. That even the same day that he was doing that, that was when the reopening for Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was getting ready to happen. Like 5 years into the making, one of the most iconic symbols of Catholicism. Lots of world leaders there. Donald Trump was there. Prince William was there. Pope Francis, the actual head of the Catholic Church, skipped it to go and put this display out in Vatican City.
And what really gets me is he's saying, well, you know, we need the violence to stop. The violence must stop. And right there with him is, like you say, the head of the Palestinian National Fund, like that funds terrorism, that is banned in Israel because it funds terrorism. And that if some, you know, the PNF is there to say, if you have a relative that commits a terrorist attack, we will pay you for the rest of your life. We will pay, you know, the family of that terrorist. We will pay them money. If he gets arrested and thrown in jail in Israel for trying to carry out a terrorist attack, we will look after the family. We will pay them. You know, if you have a relative that commits that tries to murder Jews, you hit the jackpot and we'll pay you. And he's standing, you know, like, and the Pope is talking about arms traders and people that profit from war and violence. And like one of the key guys behind it is right next to him. But he's so blinded by that because he just wants to point the finger at the Jews. And, you know, it really is horrific. I mean, you did mention, I was going to include it in the Europe section, but I'll just latch onto your comment about the Notre Dame Cathedral. I think that was a really interesting event, perhaps a milestone event as Catholicism raises its profile in Europe, to have Donald Trump, Emmanuel Macron, all of these world leaders sitting at a redone cathedral, which they put a lot of money into, a lot of music and art. And I didn't see tons of video footage of it, but I think they worked hard to try and make it look beautiful and restore it to tradition. I mean, this really, really got Europe's heritage, Europe's Christian heritage, Europe's Catholic heritage on the big screen and broadcast around the world, and drew a lot of attention and got a lot of people talking about that in a unique way, particularly in secular France. So I think that is an important milestone in Catholicism taking on a more important, more public role as Europe shifts towards this Holy Roman Empire. But coming back to Pope Francis, Trumpet editor-in-chief described his role, or the Pope's role, the Catholic Church's role in this conflict in his latest article, The Fall and Rise of Lebanon, about what is going on in the Middle East there. And he has a whole section on the Vatican's view that describes the very anti-Israel stance that they've taken since October 7th. And you can consider this even in context of what we're talking about in Syria. Israel does not want an enemy in Syria. They don't want a new force that can build up in Syria. Like, they would not want Syria to become a new Lebanon and for the resources of the Syrian army to be used and turned against Israel. They want to make sure that they have some stability there. They're getting and taking care of that, some of that themselves. But you could also see them being quite happy for a European military, European observers, something like that, to move into Syria and to make sure that Syria doesn't become this anti-Israel terrorist hotspot. But you look at what Pope Francis is saying, and he does speak for a lot of Europeans, and he does speak for a lot of Catholics. That should give Israel pause for thought that they can't trust their security to Europe. And that's a major thrust of that article from Mr. Florio on why Israel can't trust Europe with that security. Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. When we were preparing ahead of this show, Andrew and I both independently came up with different stories about trade with Latin America as our top most important stories of the week. I don't think that has ever happened before, where we've had that be the kind of the dominant story. So I thought we could discuss them both together. My story is about the creation of the world's largest free trade zone. So after 25 years, a quarter of a century of talks, the EU has finally agreed on a trade deal with the Latin American trade bloc, Mercosur. What has really driven, I think, my interest in this story is some comments that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory made back in 2009. And back then he said, it is going to affect your life dramatically. That this was a deal that we really had to watch. I mean, there's so many stories that involve EU leaders sitting down and agreeing on things, but this one is worth paying attention to. So Mercosur is a Latin American trade bloc. It's Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, Venezuela, I think, was a member. They're kicked out or suspended. There's a bunch of associate states in there as well. But it will create a free trade zone with over 700 million people. It's a big deal, especially for Germany, because Germany is this manufacturing juggernaut, and that juggernaut really revolves around getting cheap raw materials and turning them into high-quality output. And they've been in real trouble over the last few years because they used to get a whole lot of that cheap raw material from Russia.
And the Ukraine war has really put a spanner in the works in terms of doing that. So this helps them potentially get access to a lot of raw material from Latin America. One thing that a lot of people all across Europe are especially excited about is access to lithium. And there's a lot of chemicals that are used in batteries and things like that that are there in Latin America. So being able to access that more cheaply. And then on the flip side, there's the potential to sell more. So Mercosur and I think it's Brazil, but several countries, they have a 35% import duty on cars. If the car costs 50,000 euros when it's sold, because of this import duty to sell that same car in Latin America, it is now going to cost 67,500 euros once it gets over there. That makes it very hard for it to compete. But that's going to be gradually faded out. It's going to take a number of years to do that. But then there's the potential for Germany and for Europe in particular to sell a whole lot more into Latin America. So this is the deal that is agreed. I think there is more to talk about. But before I get into that, maybe in much more detail, why don't I go over to Andrew Miller, who's focused on the United States. And I think you were coming at Latin American trade this week from a slightly different direction.
Yeah, I actually do want to talk quite a bit about the EU Mercosur trade deal, but I called a different angle that was actually not so much to do with the EU, at least not yet, but was to do with the BRICS alliance, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and they've added a few more nations, smaller nations, in the past 18 months as well. So Brazil is a major South American economy that's in this informal alliance with these Asian kings of the East, Russia, China, and India. And they were talking last year at their conference about actually creating a new alternate reserve currency for use amongst the BRICS nations and their allies. Now, Donald Trump came out and addressed that this week, or I think late last week, with an announcement that he said basically any nation caught trying to develop a new reserve currency is going to be subject to 100% tariffs. He's like, we're going to basically just try to like cut you out of the U.S. economic system, which is a severe threat. But you can see, and I think in this case might be the right move for Trump to take, but it definitely cast a spotlight on America's biggest economic vulnerability. Now, in an old-fashioned trade war, the U.S. economy is worth, it generates $29 trillion a year. It's substantially bigger than China. It's substantially bigger than the entire European Union combined. And so America's in a good position to normally win an old-fashioned trade war with a country. But in this case, its biggest vulnerability, America's biggest economic weakness, is its $36 trillion national debt. We spend $1 trillion a year just on interest on the debt. That's more than we spend on our military. It's somewhere between 20 and 25% of all tax revenues collected go towards interest on the national debt. So Elon Musk and others have pointed out that America is in a position where if they keep on this deficit spending binge they're on, they're going to get to a point fairly soon within a generation where all tax revenue just goes to servicing the national debt and the country goes bankrupt. Now, so in the short term, to try to kick that can down the road as long as possible, America needs the interest on its national debt, the interest rate on its national debt to stay as low as possible. It's about 4.1% interest on a 10-year treasury bond right now, which is double what it was just a few years ago. That's one of the reasons we're now spending $1 trillion on our national debt. And if it goes up more, America could go bankrupt very quickly. The way to keep that down is to keep the dollar the reserve currency. If we didn't have a national debt, it wouldn't be as important to have the dollar as a reserve currency. But because we've got this enormous $36 trillion debt, the dollar has to stay the reserve currency if we're going to keep our interest rates low enough to afford them. So any talk by Russia, China, India, Brazil, these nations about doing a new reserve currency is an existential threat to the United States, at least until we get the debt paid down. If we could actually get the debt paid down, it would be less of a threat. So right now, Trump, he's basically put the world on notice that he's like, if you're caught trying to do that, we're going to have a major trade war with you. And your country's going to get hurt really bad because you're probably buying a lot of U.S. stuff. And it seems to have kind of worked in the short term. Both India and South Africa, which are BRICS nations, have clarified since Trump said that, like, oh, we just talked about that last year. We're not really going to do that. Please don't tariff us. But it does, and that's why I brought it as the biggest story, because it does cast a spotlight, is that Trump's got this threat that don't make a reserve currency or we're going to come after you because we need the interest rates low. But it does just highlight a fact that the BRICS nations, they touched a nerve because they know where America's economy is weak. $29 trillion economy, they might be able to win an old-fashioned trade war, but if you can actually turn that trade war into a currency war that creates a bloc that actually trades in something other than dollars and can dethrone the dollar as the world's reserve currency, you're not going to have 4% yield on a treasury bond. It's going to be much higher than that. Historically, I think in the 70s, it got up to over 12%, which if it did that today, America would be bankrupt because our $1 trillion in interest on the national debt would become $3 or $4 trillion in interest on the national debt, and all tax revenue would go to nothing but that.
It's an interesting story. I mean, it almost shows how it's a bit caught behind horse, I guess, to start creating a reserve currency before you are dominating world trade. Like, it kind of goes organically with whoever dominates world trade. And at the moment, a lot of nations are dependent on America, so America can make these kind of threats and promises. But if you have a lot of people become dominant on someone else, like Europe or like China, then you're in a very different situation. And I think this is the big risk for a Trump presidency. And this is what Bible prophecy warns about, though I think we don't know exactly when that warning would come into fruition, of if you have Europe and China kind of get together an alternative trade system, then you do start to have something big enough that their threats against the United States might be more powerful than the United States threats against them. And I think this is where, like, Latin America could become a major economic battleground during the next few years, because this Mercosur deal, where Europe is really, they'd be moving into Latin America, creating the world's largest trade bloc. This would lead to a whole lot more trade between Europe and Latin America. And this could mean Latin America already, I mean, they already, I think, get more foreign direct investment from Europe than they do from the United States. You have the fact that Brazil speaks Portuguese and so does Portugal, and that all these Spanish-speaking countries, well, Spain also speaks Spanish. So there's a lot of business links there already. And really, the flight time from Buenos Aires over to Spain or Portugal is about the same as the flight time to New York or Washington. America doesn't really have a special geographic advantage there. Already, a lot of these countries are more orientating towards Europe. That would then step up a lot with this trade deal. But it's also not a done deal. And that's where, right, I think you could see a lot of clashing heads potentially over the next few years, because France hates this deal. Germany loves it. France hates it because it threatens French farmers, that it would get a lot of cheap agriculture into Europe. And I think you can kind of understand how a farmer is going to be able to operate much more cheaply in the middle of Argentina than they are in the European Union. Labor costs are a lot lower. Regulations massively fewer, so the farmers are upset, and they will be protesting this. You very famously had the EU trying to negotiate a trade deal with Canada, only to have Wallonia, the regional parliament of Wallonia, that is not even a country, but a region of Belgium, stop the entire thing. Because one country could veto it and one part of Belgium could veto Belgium signing up to this trade deal. So Europe after that actually changed how it did trade deals. So instead of they've moved away from one country can veto it, but it's still a minority of countries. There's still a blocking minority of countries that can stop it. And Poland is dead against this. They just need to get someone like Italy on board as well. And this thing is dead in the water. So you could potentially see quite a lot of a clash as Donald Trump tries to prevent Latin America from siding with Europe. And this is what Eurointelligence wrote this week. And I think this is a really good point that ties in with Bible prophecy. It says, one unknown is whether Trump is leaning on them over Mercosur. He and his team could take a view of benign neglect over the trade policies of third countries, but they indirectly affect U.S. interests. One of the Mercosur countries is a leading member of the BRICS Plus group. China might treat an EU-Mercosur free trade area as a strategic partnership and could step up its investment and trade into this area. It would not be easy for the US to impose tariffs on the rest of the world if the rest of the world did not simultaneously unite in a pro-globalization free trade zone. So they see the risk that potentially this trade conflict leading to China joining in with basically EU plus Mercosur, and you have a rest of the world minus the United States trade bloc forming.
Right. I mean, that is that is definitely, I mentioned before about the United States having a $29 trillion economy. They're very well positioned to win trade wars. They're not too worried about this current dispute with Canada because Canada's 8% of the U.S. economy. They've got weight to throw around. But the European Union has a $19 trillion economy and China has an $18 trillion economy. So any China-EU team up is basically the one combination where 19 and 18, you're getting up to like $36, $37 trillion. You've actually outsized the United States and have more weight to throw around. It's interesting what you said about the cart before the horse too. Is like right now, it probably was a mistake on the BRICS part to start talking about a reserve currency when Donald Trump could come after you with tariffs and stop that from happening. You will kind of need the free trade zone first. Which is interesting. I've actually got an older article here from 2013 by Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg, the German politician, titled Transatlantic Trade and Its Discontents. And it wasn't about the Mercosur Agreement. It was about the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That was a proposed free trade and investment deal between Canada, the United States, and Europe. That never happened. But he did make an interesting comment at the end where he said, given the complexity of the deal, it may be best to seek what Commissioner de Gucht called a living agreement, one that can be furthered if and when politics allow. We would suggest that it would also be living from a geographical perspective. An open-ended nature of the groundbreaking 1957 Treaty of Rome, which enshrined the concept of an ever closer union in Europe, should be used as a template. And so kind of showing that like these free trade is normally like a gateway, trade union is a gateway into political union. Britain found that out the hard way when they joined the European Union. They're the common market. They're like, oh yeah, we want free trade. We love this common market. And then found out that it actually just evolves into like this political union. And when Gutenberg's writing about this, and I think he speaks for a lot of people in Europe, that this free trade deal in Latin America isn't just going to stay like a tariff-free zone. As you start integrating your economies, whether you want to or not, and I think they want to, you're going to be able to exercise more political control over Latin America. I think it's the Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet, chapter 7, Building Towards a World Catastrophe, where Mr. Gerald Fleury talks about a prophesied union between the European Union and Latin America, but says it's not going to be a union of equals. The Latin American nations are going to end up as colonies of Europe. And a free trade zone can get you a long way there. Like at the start, it doesn't. I mean, that's why America's founding fathers were very pro-tariff. And the reason wasn't because that was the best thing to increase America's standard of living. It actually probably hurt it a little bit. But they knew they had to decouple their economy from Britain if they actually wanted to remain politically independent from Britain long term. And so this this EU-Latin America thing is kind of the reverse of that. It's like, okay, you start out with like free trade and you're helping each other's economies, and maybe not in the farmer's case, but as the economies of Latin America and Europe get intertwined, like Gutenberg said, you can use the Treaty of Rome as a template to kind of start doing to Latin America what you already did to the European Union, where you've got this quasi-political union where you can actually start making political demands because your economies are so intertwined already.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that point. I mean, even that point about colonies, I've seen people in the press making the same point, that this Mercosur deal almost returns Latin America to a colonial status, because this is why Europe wants it, is it allows them access to raw materials that they can get from Latin America in a similar way to colonies. And then, I mean, your point about political influence is also, I think, a really good one. Like, this is baked in to all European Union deals kind of even already. Like, part of the Mercosur trade deal is they have to sign up to a bunch of European climate policies. Now, part of this is there's reasonable, like, this is the concern of the French farmers. If we have to submit to all of these climate regulations, but their farmers don't, it's unfair competition, because we have all of these extra expenses that they don't have, so they'll be able to produce food much more cheaply. And so Europe's answer is, well, as we negotiate a trade deal, we want to get everyone else to sign up to all of these other pieces of regulation too. But I think it goes further than that. There's rules about deforestation. I mean, nobody really wants the Amazon rainforest to be deforested. I think everyone values that, though. You know how Europe is. They're very good at then using things that everybody wants, like clean air and whatever, as an excuse to have a ridiculously long list of regulations. But that kind of thing is happening already.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of ironic that they call it a free trade deal, which when you just hear it makes it sound like, oh, yeah, well, like, I'm free to trade with whoever I want. And then they're like, oh, yeah. And here's the 2000 pages of stipulations you have to follow. But it's interesting, too, that that Germany is the one pushing for this, even against French opposition, because Germany's actually got a lot of experience with this type of thing. When I heard about this Mercosur deal, one quote I read years ago that always stuck with me, I brought with me, it's from a book by William Manchester called The Arms of Krupp. I've actually got it with me here. And it's about the history of the Krupp family's like support of the Holy Roman Empire. But in a more recent historical example, after World War II, after Hitler fell and all that, when Krupp was expanding their markets into Eastern Europe, they summarized it, Manchester summarizes it this way on the last page of the chapter, The Flag Follows Trade. He says, under Wilhelmine imperialism, he reminded them, trade had followed the flag. Now the Konzern would reverse it, and the New Reich schoolboys would learn the flag follows trade. And it shows that, like I said, basically under Kaiser Wilhelm and the old 19th century way Germany operated, you invaded a country, and then when you'd conquered it militarily, you started trading with it and integrating its economy. This one, like Germany, under the Krupps and figures, like said, well, if we can actually start selling so many goods in Eastern Europe that the Eastern Europeans become dependent on Germany, we can hoist the German flag later. We've already got our foot in the door. It was interesting that the Krupps were thinking that way all the way back in the 50s and 60s, because those Eastern European nations didn't join the European Union till like 2004. So there's a few decades of free trade before they're like, okay, now you're actually just part of this new German-led EU empire. And so now Latin America is getting to the point now where the like Romania and Poland were a few decades ago. The trades moved in, and then the flag will eventually follow. And then once you actually have, I think between the European Union and Mercosur, there's like 700 million people in this trade block. You get those 700 million people in like an EU-style political block. Well, then you can start talking about a new reserve currency to replace the dollar. And Trump can't just tariff you piecemeal. You lose the option to just say, like, well, I'm going to tariff Brazil if they make a reserve currency. You've got to tariff the entire 700 million trade block. In that case, like I said, their population outnumbers America 2-1. The joint Europe-South America economy on a GDP basis is still smaller than the United States, but it might not remain that way if the free trade deal boosts production in some way in those nations. So you've got a real threat on your hand.
Yeah, I mean, going back to your point about Eastern Europe, I mean, that is exactly what has happened. Like, you look at a list, this is a couple of years old, but you look at a list of the top biggest companies in Eastern Europe. This is from January 2022. The second biggest company with the second largest turnover in Eastern Europe was Skoda, which, of course, is a subsidiary now of Volkswagen. The sixth biggest company is Volkswagen Slovakia. Just it's registered as a separate country. And you just keep going down the list. Audi Hungary is the eighth biggest country in Eastern Europe. Little Poland was the 10th. The Hungarian branch of NVM, a German energy company, was 13th. Bosch, 17th. Like, you look at what are the biggest manufacturers in all of these countries, and for so many of them, it's people that make parts for German cars. And it's like the entire Danube just feeds car parts for the German car industry. And it means that it's very hard for these countries to stand apart from Germany when push comes to shove. And I think that is why it's so interesting that this Mercosur deal is coming up now, and we're going to have this Franco-German power struggle now. And I think it is entirely possible that we do have to wait longer even before this deal, okay, it's signed, but before the EU ratifies it. And I'll just read what Mr. Flurry wrote about that, because I think it is important to take note of, and it does tie in directly with that. He said, before Europe can be closely tied to Latin America, something will have to change. This was in 2019. The current political and religiously disunited EU will have to become politically, military, and religiously unified Holy Roman Empire. Latin America is already quite united in its religion. The Holy Roman Empire will have to become united in its religion as well. And the only way to remove the division is by reducing that union to 10 nations. So it might, like, the EU in its current form may not be able to make this happen. But we're talking about this at the same time where we've got the political crisis and Europe being without a leader. This was later in my notes. I'll talk about it now. But Spain this week, the Spanish government lost their majority in parliament. Yeah, so Pedro Sanchez, the Catalan separatist party, split with him and said, we're no longer going to support him. They called for a confidence vote against him. The thing is, in Spain, Parliament can't force out a prime minister. So the fact that he's lost his majority doesn't mean that he has to quit tomorrow in the same way that it would like France or Germany. But it does mean you've got a lame duck prime minister in Spain. And then you've got France that is in complete turmoil and had their government fall a week or two ago. And they're just trying to get support now for a new prime minister. Germany's heading towards elections. Like, almost every large country in Europe, I think Poland and Italy would be the only exceptions, have pretty much no leadership. And then you've got this Mercosur in the mix. Maybe it will take the rise of a strong leader to force this through. Now, Perhaps it will even play a role in the rise of this strong leader, and that this is yet another reason for Europe to unite behind someone that can get things done. And I think we could see that strong leader very quickly as Europe tries to navigate a dangerous world with no leadership. It's making them realize, hey, even if we can't get a strong leader in democratically, we're going to find a way to get one. But I think it's also going to, you're also going to see this change of Europe becoming more religious that I talked about with Mihailo earlier when we were talking about some of the Pope's comments, that as you see Catholicism playing a major role in Europe, that is then going to be have a major role in linking them to Latin America. But I think if you look at the way things are right now, China also has huge influence in Latin America. And China has, you know, we've been talking on this show, they've been building new ports in Peru, and Jeremiah had that on a couple of weeks ago. Why would we talk about Latin America being especially close to Europe when you could make the case that the economic relationship is really growing between them and China? Well, there's also this added cultural dimension. Yes, there's the shared languages, some shared history with Europe, but the shared religion is going to become really powerful, and that we'll see more as we see Europe shift more into this Holy Roman Empire that is even more dominated by the Catholic Church. And then also, Mr. Fleury mentioned Europe shrinking down to 10 nations. We're forecasting the rise of this Holy Roman Empire dominated by the Catholic Church and led by a strong man, because that's what Revelation 17 describes in biblical language, a beast power with 10 kings that's led by a woman, that's a church in biblical symbolism. And it says that this is 10 kings, not 27 kings like you have now in Europe. And so we've been saying, well, Europe is going to shrink down. And you can see how, yeah, with 27 nations, it makes it really hard, and they can't sign a deal with Canada. And they did eventually get the deal with Canada through. They placated the Walloons. But it makes it so cumbersome. And so they are going to shrink down to 10. Maybe they'll have to shrink down to 10 before they get this deal. So I think there might be, you know, perhaps Donald Trump will get in there for a little bit even and try to play European powers against them, each other, and find a way to slow down the ratification of this Mercosur deal. But once you see that transformation in Europe, certainly then you're going to see this tight partnership between Europe and Latin America. And that is when you've got currency wars, you've got trade wars. I think you'd almost talk about resource wars as this separate characteristic, where we almost talked about it on last week's show, where China came along and said, we're not selling rare earth minerals to the United States. And this is because of stupid decisions from the United States and from Britain as well, where you need rare earth metals in small amounts for just about all technology. You know, if you're going to make computer chips, you need rare earth metals to do it. And they're called rare earth metals. They're not massively rare. America has them, but it's very polluting to get them out of the ground and refine them. And America puts all kinds of regulations on companies that do that. Which, okay, reasonable. Like, nobody wants their landscape looking terrible. But the upshot is that China doesn't care. So China manufactures and mines all these rare earth metals in the most polluting way possible. The American manufacturers can't compete, so they shut down. And now you have the situation where China has just cornered the market on rare earth metals. I think it's like 95%, 96% it was a few years ago. Finally, some of the rest of the world has started to wake up to this, and that's been changing. But now China turned around and said to the United States, okay, you're threatening us with tariffs. We're not going to sell you rare earth minerals. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. If, you know, Donald Trump is willing to play a lot of Trump cards that could be pretty aggressive against China, so maybe he'll get them to back down. But China did this, 12, 13 years ago against Japan, and they won, and Japan backed down, because they needed access to this relatively small amount of resources, but they just couldn't do without them.
Yeah, I think we did mention last week too that, China's put a ton of investment into a deep water port in Peru, which is hugely significant. I didn't know that. I was shocked when I looked at the map, but I looked at a map of deep water ports in in the Americas, and on the Pacific coast, there is currently no deep water port south of California. I think there's a couple in Canada. Most are in the United States. So now, like, if you're looking for something like lithium, like you actually have to ship that, even if the lithium's going from Peru to China, you actually have to put it on a shallow water port onto a small boat that ships it up to California, and then the Californians can ship it across to China. And so they're having to dredge this thing out because there's no natural deep water ports on the Pacific coast of South America to make this deep water port. But that's specifically designed, it will save them some time. I think some of the Latin Americans were saying that, like I said, well, right now we can sell lithium to China, but we can't sell blueberries to China because they go bad by the time they get there. It's just too long. So it's like this deep water port will be great if you're a Peruvian blueberry farmer, because you've now got more markets you can send to. But it does cut America out of the system, which we're not so concerned about the blueberry trade. But like lithium is something, because some things like manufactured goods, America's too reliant on China for manufactured goods. It would be great if you could decouple our economy somewhat from China's economy and actually start making some of these things we need closer to home. But then when it comes to natural resources like lithium, it's not like opening a truck factory in Texas or a clothes factory in Alabama. You kind of got to go where the lithium is. And so you're that makes Chile, the nation of Chile, very important from a strategic sense. And so you, when you're doing these tariffs and you're doing these trade wars, you don't want China to outcompete you in the nations that actually have natural resources that you need.
And I think this brings us nicely to the article I've been quoting from this whole time, America is being besieged economically, that Mr. Flory wrote in 2019, that talks about exactly that, that these different powers coming on and cutting America off from raw materials and all of these other elements of trade war and things like that as well. But there's a he focuses a lot of this on a specific warning in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52, where Deuteronomy is a promise of blessings to the United States and to Britain. This is a message to Israel. And as Herbert W. Armstrong showed in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, modern Israel is the Jews in the Middle East. Yeah, they're descendant of Israel, but they're a descendant of just one tribe, the tribe of Judah. Britain and America are also descendants of Israel. And you can prove that from your Bible. You can turn to these scriptures and you can see where Britain and America, or where Abraham's descendants, were promised huge amounts of wealth, huge amounts of power, promises that have never been fulfilled in ancient Israel, in the Jews. And one of these promises is that they would possess the gates of their enemies. And okay, when you're talking about gates on a national scale, like what does that mean? What is a gate that can open and close to an entire nation? Well, one fulfillment of that is sea gates. If you own the Straits of Gibraltar, that's a gate of the enemy. Like you can close or open up the Mediterranean Sea, or the Panama Canal is a gate on a national scale. And you can tell who the descendants of Israel are. You could tell only by who owns these sea gates. But Mr. Armstrong has a whole bunch more proofs than that. There's a whole lot of proof that he has in that book. So God promised that Britain and America would have these gates. But then he also said if they didn't obey in Deuteronomy 28, these would be taken away. Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52 says, "He shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted throughout all your land. And he shall besiege you in all your gates throughout all your land, which the Eternal your God has given you." And if you think about this in context of the United States, well, if the United States is going to be besieged and cut off from global trade, well, part of that is the whole rest of the world coming together to cut America off from trade. And if you're going to do that, you also need Latin America. Like, that's where the crucial sea gates for the United States are. Most of American trade comes through the Gulf of Mexico. Even 45% of America's internal trade. So I guess trade from one city to another city in the United States, it goes through the Gulf of Mexico. Maybe that's ocean-borne trade, but that's a really high statistic. So this area is crucial if you're going to cut off from world trade. And then there's other prophecies, such as those in Isaiah 23, that describe Britain and China coming together in a temporary trade alliance and trading with each other. So that's the picture that you get. You get a new trade bloc, exactly like we read about earlier, where you have the EU and you have China, and then you have Latin America, and all of these trade together. And they cut America out of world trade, and they use their links to Latin America to then wage economic war on the United States until America is weakened enough that they can even be taken over militarily, physically. And that's what the Bible warns about here. That's where this Mercosur trade deal is leading. Now, we've also said there's going to be a reprieve from some of this under President Donald Trump. So how quickly you see that, you know, maybe it will take a year, or maybe it will take some weeks or months before the EU ratifies this Mercosur deal. And maybe you will have some very strong trade moves from Donald Trump that brings some stability and prosperity to the United States. But if America doesn't repent, you're going to get those curses in Deuteronomy chapter 28. And that's where this story is leading. And that article, America is being besieged economically, will take you through all of those different prophecies.
Yeah, those are definitely some sobering prophecies to think about. And like I hinted at earlier, if like that Mercosur trade bloc was already an economic political union, and they introduced a new reserve currency, and the interest rates on a U.S. Treasury bond spiked to 8 or 9%, America would be bankrupt already. So that shows how suddenly something like this could happen. That's kind of like a master stroke. But they need to get the trade bloc in place first. If they start talking about a reserve currency now, Trump can just tariff individual nations. He can hold them at bay. But once you get the trade bloc in place, you've got a serious threat, and that's something America needs to be very concerned about. The fact that they've let their national debt get to $36 trillion in the first place is definitely a sin the country has to repent of. But there's also some other big news this week. One story involving an Anglo-Saxon nation that's not America, involving Australia, as they're starting to wake up somewhat to this threat, this economic threat from China. Just signed a security deal this week with the nation of Nauru, a little island nation in the Pacific Ocean, that they're hoping to kind of use to at least slow down China's hegemony over the Pacific Ocean. Some other developments in the ongoing war between Ukraine and Russia and America's involvement with that. Biden, whose family has been neck deep in corruption in Ukraine for many years now, just decided that he's going to rush out billions of more dollars in aid to Ukraine just as he walks out the door. I think he's worried that under a Trump administration, there's going to be a little more oversight into where some of that aid's going. And so wants to get as much out the door as possible. Although it could, that decision, even though I'm not sure if that Biden meant it this way, could actually help bring about an end to that war, to actually just show some more American involvement there. Because now that Syria's collapsed, or the Assad regime in Syria's collapsed, that definitely puts Russia in a much weaker position. And so now even Donald Trump is calling for an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine, seeing that the fact that Biden's thrown all this money towards buying Ukrainian weapons at the same time that Russia's kind of on the back foot with some of its allies in Syria and the other places, definitely puts America in a strong negotiating position start bringing that war closer to an end. And hopefully they get a good deal. I mean, that's the other thing tying into the stories we've already been talking about, is I'm sure whatever deal they come in place is going to do Europe some favors as well, helping Europe strengthen its control over Eastern Europe, which could come back to bite America in the future as they develop these huge transcontinental trade blocks. But in the short term, I think there's definitely a lot of people hoping that Trump's ceasefire in Ukraine is going to come sooner rather than later.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. I think I've managed to dribble in all of my other stories I wanted to hit throughout the rest of the show. I think the only other thing I wanted to mention was the dramatic news from Romania this week, where last week Jeremiah and I were talking about a Russian interference in Romania, and then shortly after we finished making and editing that show, and I think we were like in the process of uploading it, Romania cancelled their whole elections and said we're redoing it, which, you know, I think the government coming along and saying you got the answer wrong, try again, adds a very different color to everything that we were talking about last week. And that was, you know, everything that we recorded, we did that before that announcement. So we came back on Wednesday and talked about it in light of that new change. And I think it's a really interesting story, because I think the evidence of Russia interfering in that election is very compelling. But then redoing a whole election because you don't like the result, that's not particularly democratic either. And that is so very EU. Like, it feels like we're back to the Nice Treaty and the Lisbon Treaty and the EU saying, wrong answer, try again. And so really, I mean, can democracy survive as it is trampled on by both the European consensus and by Russia? So that's what we got into on the Wednesday show, as well as getting an update from Mihailo on, well, what next for Syria? Where is that leading? I think we ended up uploading that to YouTube in two different parts, so you can go and look that up if either of those interest you. Regular viewers may have noticed we're missing a man, Jeremiah Jacques, unfortunately, our Asia correspondent. He is off sick today. So I was going to cover some news from Asia for him, and I am doing a horrible job of it because we've got like minutes left. And yeah, here's one story from Asia to still give that a segment. So China deployed its largest naval fleet in almost 30 years near Taiwan. Taiwan's defense ministry said that on December 10th. So China has nearly 90 naval and coast guard vessels in that area. And this is this kind of escalation, it's saber rattling. I think it's also, it spreads fear, but it also, like, Russia does this before they invade somewhere. You keep kind of poking the airspace, you keep doing drills right next door, so that, oh, it's like, oh, China's massing their ships in the Taiwan Strait again. Well, they've done that before, it's not a big deal. So they kind of keep doing some of these things, but definitely watch for the pressure on Taiwan as they're rising, as China's rising as a power. They'll want to push this potential US ally, or real US ally, away from their waters so they can spread their navy out, so that they're not besieged themselves, and that they can push this besiegement of the United States themselves. Well, that is about all that we do have time for. Very sorry, Jeremiah. I'll try and give you more time next week. We will put links in the show notes to everything that we have talked about. I will just plug that article again. America is being besieged economically. It's a great, thorough way to prove some of these prophecies in more detail that you can go through with your Bible and understand why this Mercosur deal and why these relationships with the BRICS and things like that is so important. And for all of these, we'll put links in our show notes. If you scroll down on YouTube or on Rumble, we'll have links that you can go to so that you can read these articles and get in more depth and get into your Bible in more depth. I mean, this is all about showing you that God rules in world events and bringing the Bible to life. But it requires a little bit more study to do that than just sitting and listening to a show. So we'd love for you to dig into that to prove what we're saying. If you doubt what we're saying, if you're like, well, the Bible doesn't say that, where in the Bible does it say that? Go to the article. It's got the links. It's got the scripture references. We've mentioned one or two. That will give you a whole lot more. And that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, as well, is just an excellent place to go to prove for yourself what the Bible says about end time events. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Andrew. Thank you to Mihailo who joined me earlier. Thank you to Isaac Lorenz and George Haddad for engineering and production. Thank you to you, the viewer. You can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com or leave us a comment on YouTube or Rumble. Don't forget to like and subscribe. That all really, really helps us. Be great if we can get our subscriber numbers up above 36,000 by the end of the weekend. It's been growing quite nicely this week. We will be back for our regular show on Wednesday. And until then, keep watching your world.